JFK, why he died and why it matters.
This is the story of John Kennedy. It's not the story of the plot, although I tell the plot, but it's the story of a person who turned against a way that was destructive toward a way that is peaceful and just. And from that point on, he and his enemy, Nikita Khrushchev, begin to work together. And that's the beginning of the end of John Kennedy.
That's James Douglas. We spend the hour talking with him about his book, JFK and the Unspeakable. This is Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. For many young Americans, 9/11 was a defining moment of their generation, after which the world would never be the same. For older generations, the assassination of John F. Kennedy on November 22, 1963, changed our world. At that time, I was still young enough to miss just how much a change it would mean. That would come with the murders of Malcolm X, JFK's brother Robert, and then Martin Luther King. All four assassinations happened within a period of 5 years. My guest, James W. Douglas, thinks the murders were connected by a common thread, the threat the victims had posed while alive to what Dwight Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex. In his meticulously researched book, JFK and the Unspeakable, Douglas turns his attention to the first assassination of the four. The book explores the covert forces behind the assassination, including the CIA and Lee Harvey Oswald's role within it. But even more fascinating, it examines Kennedy's turn toward peace, what he learned from the Bay of Pigs, his internal conflict over Vietnam, and his confrontation with the power of Big Steel over government military contracts. In doing so, Douglas gives not just the how of JFK's murder, but the why. His growing determination to break up what he saw as the greatest threat to peace in the world and to democracy at home, the national security state. Oliver Stone, who made the film JFK, says it's one of those rare books that by helping us understand our history has the power to change it. Jim Douglas is a longtime peace activist and Christian theologian. He co-founded the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action in Washington State. In 1997, he and his wife received the Pachem Interes Award for the work on behalf of peace. Well, Jim Douglas, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
70% of Americans think that Kennedy was killed as a result of a conspiracy, and you are one of them. You lay out in great detail in this book, JFK and the Unspeakable, you lay out in great detail the evidence that JFK was assassinated by the CIA, and that, for example, Lee Harvey Oswald was a CIA asset. So when I saw the title of your book, JFK and the Unspeakable, I assumed you meant by the unspeakable the conspiracy that killed him. It is that, but it's really more than that. Where does this term come from?
It comes from a man named Thomas Merton, a great writer, a great spiritual leader, actually, for many of us. And Merton wrote a book in the 1960s called Raids on the Unspeakable. And by it, he meant a kind of evil that goes really beyond the capacity of words to describe, a kind of systemic evil that we don't want to go to, that we don't want to recognize, that we're in denial of. And he gave us examples of it, the Vietnam War, the nuclear arms race, and what was going on then here domestically, the assassinations of the President John Kennedy and Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, and Robert Kennedy. So the unspeakable is much more than a conspiracy around a particular leader. It's more a dimension of evil and of our denial of it that goes beyond what anything we want to say or recognize.
You said that Merton was a leader for many of us. Tell us about your own background and what brought you, what in that brought you to doing this book.
I'm a peace activist and a former professor, and I knew Thomas Merton. We corresponded, and I also taught at a college not far from him, Bellarmine College, in Louisville, Kentucky. He was at the Abbey of Gethsemane, about a 45-minute drive from where I was teaching, and I had corresponded with him for years before that. And those of us who were then struggling with the Vietnam War, of course, that was a huge number of people, but those of us especially who were in the Catholic peace movement, what would have been called the Catholic left, we relied on Merton's insights especially. Now, he was a contemplative, and he didn't read newspapers very often, and he didn't have television, but he had an uncanny understanding of what was going on, and he corresponded with everyone on the face of the earth almost, including people in the Beltway, including the president's sister-in-law, Robert Kennedy's wife, Ethel Kennedy, and he corresponded with many people who were in that circle or who were in counter-circles. For example, Claire Booth Luce, who took a diametrically opposed position to the Kennedys on many, many things. Anyhow, Merton was my spiritual guide, almost literally, when I knew him and in my book as I wrote it.
You say you were in the Catholic peace movement.
Am.
That's right. You're in the Catholic peace movement.
Yes.
There, and Kennedy was also a Catholic, a deeply religious man. Tell me, what is the connection between your work against Vietnam and also the anti-nuclear work that you did and your interest in JFK?
While JFK was alive, of course, I was critical of his nuclear policies. It was not something that I supported at all. I felt that he was very much involved, as he was, in preparing for a nuclear war, and I was in the process of studying a theology of peace and trying to understand a way within the background I had as a Catholic layperson of working from a spiritual base to resist nuclear war. Of course, that meant going to people like Thomas Merton and, in a wider perspective, Mohandas Gandhi, Dorothy Day in the Catholic Worker Movement, people with that kind of background. But Kennedy, unknown to me, he knew Dorothy Day. He had visited her in the Bowery in New York at a Catholic Worker house, a very, very poor place before the Second World War. And Kennedy had an appreciation of, I guess, listening to people and taking his own stands, independent stands, in ways that I didn't understand while he was alive. So while my articles were counter his public positions, as I learned in many years later, he was taking private positions that corresponded to what I hoped a leader like he would take. For example, pulling missiles out of Turkey at the same time as Khrushchev was pulling missiles out of Cuba, reciprocal kinds of things, and disarmament policies that went far, far beyond his own national security state.
Yeah, in fact, you talk about an evolution in JFK's thinking about war and peace that had roots in his own experience of suffering.
Yes.
Talk about that.
JFK suffered his entire life. He was a person who hardly ever referred to that, but he was dying time after time, from childhood illnesses to problems with his back, and then, of course, his almost dying in the Second World War, and there was death all around him, other members of his family, and Even when he was in the House in the Senate and became president, he was terribly ill virtually all the time. And so death was like an angel on his shoulder. He was quite familiar with death, and he was not afraid to die. That is critical in understanding Kennedy's character. His favorite poem was about death, I Have a Rendezvous with Death, and he was willing to embrace death. He wanted to do it in a courageous way. That's the theme of the poem, as written by a man who did die, recognizing that that was going to happen. So,
and who was the author of that poem?
He was a man in the Second World War who had a very similar background to Kennedy, who had been at Harvard and who then died as he volunteered for the war. His name was Alan Seeger. He was actually a poet who was admired by T.S. Eliot, and Kennedy had that poem down, and Jacqueline Kennedy, at the end of their honeymoon, she learned it, and she recited it back to him throughout his life. Seeger's poem became a part of Kennedy's and her marriage, and then she even taught it to their daughter, Caroline, in the fall of 1963, and she recited it back to him in, of all places, the middle of a national security meeting on the White House lawn one afternoon in an amazing scene with his national security advisor sitting in a circle around this five-year-old girl telling her father about his commitment to death.
Wow. Now, that was just a few months or even weeks, it must have been, before he died.
Yes, it was just about a month before his death. So she was, came up to the meeting and then this lovely day where they were meeting outside, and she just kept tugging at his coat, and finally he turned to her and said, go ahead, what did she want? And then she just went into I Have a Rendezvous with Death, and their eyes were locked on each other, and a man who witnessed this and who was in that circle and later described it said it was as if there was a communion between the two of them.
Hmm. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with James W. Douglas about his book, JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. Now, you mentioned how you had seen Kennedy. I was 13 when he was assassinated.
Yes.
But I have a much more vivid memory, actually, even of his assassination, and that is of the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yes.
I was telling a young friend of mine today that I remember that time very, very well. I remember the feeling that I had of imminent annihilation at any point. I remembered walking to school and looking up nervously at the sky. Every time a plane went overhead, I thought that was it. So my experience of Kennedy, even though, I was just a young girl, really, my experience of him was as a cold warrior. And yet, there's a much more nuanced picture that you paint in this book, and you say it had everything to do with why he was assassinated. Could you just tell us, just sketch out for us, what are the most salient parts of what you think led to his assassination, and then maybe we'll go into each one a little more deeply.
Early in his presidency, he had a sharp conflict with the Central Intelligence Agency, and that deepened as he went along. The event was the Bay of Pigs, and he felt that he had been deeply manipulated and lied to by the CIA to put him in a false position where he would be forced to do what he had said he would absolutely not do, which was send U.S. troops into Cuba or reinforce the exile brigade that the CIA had trained with U.S. forces. He said he wouldn't do that. But they set him up, he realized afterwards, by lying to him about a revolution they knew was not going to occur in Cuba, a counter-revolution against Castro, and with terrain where the CIA-trained exiles could not go into a kind of retreat if necessary. He'd been set up in a whole series of ways. Afterwards, he said, I want to splinter the CIA in 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds.
So you're actually saying that they knew it was going to fail, and they wanted to set, that the Bay of Pigs, they wanted to send in these paramilitaries so that they would fail, so that the U.S. would have to invade Cuba.
Exactly. And the invasion, of course, they knew would be huge because the U.S. had the forces to overwhelm Cuba, but Kennedy was totally opposed to doing such a thing, but he realized that they had set him up that way. And we even have, as I've cited, the notes of Alan Dulles acknowledging that in things that he never wrote publicly. And there are many sources today, including government sources, for this having happened. There's not any real question it happened.
Well,
what is significant is Kennedy's response to it.
So before you tell us that, tell us who Alan Dulles was.
He was the legendary CIA director who, throughout the 1950s, controlled covert action throughout the world for the Central Intelligence Agency. And it was during those years that, working also with his brother, John Foster Dulles, who was Secretary of State under Eisenhower, that Alan Dulles was creating all kinds of coups, assassinations, sabotage all over the world on behalf of the U.S. as part of the Cold War. So Alan Dulles was no small figure in U.S. intelligence. He was the major figure, and Kennedy fired him. He fired him after the Bay of Pigs, and he fired his chief lieutenants because of what they did. And then who winds up as being the key member of the Warren Commission investigating Kennedy's murder? Alan Dulles. So we've got the Fox investigating the murder in the hen house. He should have been identified as the chief suspect.
So what kind of sources do you have to back up your claim that Dulles was in fact the fox on the Warren Commission?
The way in which he acted on the Warren Commission is heavy evidence of the cover-up. He was working adroitly. Of course, he had been fired from the CIA, but he was still very, very close to the CIA. And he was passing communications back and forth to the man who had worked under him, Helms, and the other who was director of covert action within the Central Intelligence Agency, and other people within the agency to give them everything that the Warren Commission was working on, and vice versa, to shield from the Warren Commission critical information within the CIA. So there isn't really any paper trail or any trail that you could say identifies Dulles as the mastermind of the assassination. But as for being a key player in the cover-up, that's easily established by Warren Commission documents and CIA documents and what was going back and forth between him and the CIA.
So why did the CIA want to go into Cuba, and why would John F. Kennedy want to thwart that?
Well, the CIA was a part of a much larger reality, our national security state, and that was part of a further huge reality, the Cold War. And we had a kind of overarching theology, which continues to be an overarching theology. It's us versus them, absolute good versus absolute evil, the free world versus the communist world. And within the, quote, free world, we had to defend our nuclear weapons especially. And that meant covert action of all kinds to counter what we saw as the communists' evil designs at every point over against us. And certainly there were things going on counter to us of a suspicious nature. And so a doctrine called plausible deniability was created under the National Security Council, and it meant that the CIA was authorized in those days, and this continues to be the case today, to carry out what we would regard as criminal actions, overthrowing governments, assassinating people, sabotaging, doing all kinds of lying, propaganda, and to deny that plausibly. In other words, there could be no real connection between what the CIA did that could be really visible and its source in the United States government. And that became so proficient that it enabled the Central Intelligence Agency to coordinate the murder of the President of the United States.
That's a pretty major allegation that you've made, that it was the U.S., that in fact this was an extrajudicial murder by the national security establishment itself.
Yes.
You know, there are an awful lot of people who have thought this and claimed this, and, you know, they've been dismissed as conspiracy theorists. What makes your book different than theirs? What makes you, what have you done that you feel has been, you know, because you don't have the kind of background that's typical, let's say, of a, quote, conspiracy theorist, unquote.
No.
So tell us, what has made your book different?
Well, this is the story of John Kennedy. It's not the story of the plot, although I tell the plot, and the plot is necessary. But it's the story of a person who turned, turning. That's a biblical concept. The Hebrew is shuva, and Greek it's metanoia, and we translate it repentance. But the meaning of it is turning against a way that was destructive toward a way that is peaceful and just, the way of the Creator. And Kennedy did that, and he was, just as you understood him, a cold warrior. He was a person who ran for office as President of the United States with a very militant platform, and very militant in regard to Cuba and the Soviet Union, and his inaugural address has elements of that, although it also has elements, peaceful elements. But Kennedy turned, and partly it was in reaction to the way in which he was being manipulated by his own national security state, the way also Truman and Eisenhower had been. But Kennedy decided to be president of the United States rather than to take orders from his national security state. So as things moved along, he took a stand in the midst of the missile crisis that was absolutely critical to our survival as a people and to the survival of the world. And that's the most significant turning point. And from that point on, he and his enemy, Nikita Khrushchev, begin to work together. And that's the beginning of the end of John Kennedy, and also, not incidentally, of Nikita Khrushchev in the Soviet Union.
Really?
Neither became tolerable from the standpoint of his own national security state.
Wow, I didn't know that Nikita Khrushchev also suffered from that. It's a remarkable story you tell in the book, Jim Douglas. The book is JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. Just kind of give us the cliff notes of that remarkable friendship, in fact, that developed between these two leaders, JFK and Nikita Khrushchev.
They only met one time in their lives, and that was in Vienna. And the meeting didn't go especially well, and they did begin to negotiate on some key issues. But in that meeting, Kennedy, in an aside, suggested to Khrushchev that they needed to talk or communicate less formally, rather than being under the lights and the cameras and with microphones all over. And so they began a secret correspondence. And the first letter came from Khrushchev that fall, when they were in the midst of a huge crisis over Berlin. And Khrushchev wrote a beautiful letter to Kennedy, reflecting on the Black Sea, where he had his home. And he used a biblical symbol. This is the communist Khrushchev choosing Noah's Ark as the symbol of what he and Kennedy had to do, keep the Ark afloat in the sea of nuclear weapons. And Kennedy, after he had this letter smuggled to him in a newspaper that was handed to his press secretary by a KGB agent posing as a press person, Kennedy responded to that beautiful letter by one of his own, writing from Hyannisport beside the sea also, and reflecting similar fashion and saying, yes, the Ark is our symbol, let us keep that Ark afloat. And so in their secret correspondence, they struggled with these issues, contentious issues between them, but they began, almost in spite of themselves, to trust each other. So when it came to their huge conflict in the missile crisis, in which Kennedy thought Khrushchev had lied to him, he in fact had lied to him, and snuck missiles into Cuba, but of course Khrushchev thought Kennedy, since his forces had already invaded the Bay of Pigs in terms of the Cuban exile community, that he might do it again, that they needed nuclear weapons to deter the U.S. I mean, each of them had a piece of the truth. But in the midst of the missile crisis, then, they had as a foundation their relationship in these letters. And when Kennedy found himself losing control to his generals, who were doing all kinds of things to provoke the Soviet Union in a way that could then give us an excuse or give them an excuse for an all-out missile attack to, quote, win the Cold War, Kennedy sent Robert, his brother, the Attorney General, secretly to the ambassador of the Soviet Union in Washington and appealed for help. They couldn't get out of the situation, and they're afraid that the generals were going to, if not take over, at least provoke a war. And Dobrynin, he wired that he was the Soviet ambassador. He wired Khrushchev, and Khrushchev, when he got this message, he turned to his foreign minister in Moscow and said, amazingly, "We have to let Kennedy know that we want to help him." And the foreign minister couldn't believe what he was hearing, and Khrushchev almost couldn't believe what he was saying, and he repeated it. He said, "Yes, we now have a common cause to save the world from those pushing us toward war." And at that moment, everything turned upside down in the Cold War, and John Kennedy and Nikita Khrushchev became closer to each other in their perceptions in the midst of a darkness where we'd almost had a nuclear war than either was to his own national security state. And that's the story. That's the essence of it. And that's the astounding turning of not only Kennedy, but also Khrushchev.
And we did, in fact, come very, very close, as was discovered after the fall of the Soviet Union.
Yes.
Now, Kennedy secretly taped some conversations in the Oval Office during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Talk about those.
He taped virtually all of them. These were conversations of all his national security advisors. There was a group called the Executive Committee of the National Security Council, a specially designated group to carry him through the missile crisis, and deliberated at great length on each part of the struggle on what to do. And the meeting that reveals most profoundly Kennedy's position and his alienation from the military is a meeting with his Joint Chiefs of Staff. It's just him alone, nobody else, and the Joint Chiefs, the heads of all the different services, Army, Navy, Air Force, and so forth. And General Curtis LeMay is the major counter to Kennedy, and is really not only arrogant, but dismissive of the president, and telling him that his position of a quarantine, actually a blockade around Cuba, is as bad as the compromises with Hitler before the Second World War, and he's just insulting him. And Kennedy refuses to go with the Joint Chiefs' pressures to invade Cuba or to bomb Cuba. He very politely tells him that's not going to be done. And then he walks out of the room. And, of course, this is all on tape, and the tape keeps recording, and we hear LeMay and the other generals not only dismissing Kennedy, but doing so in very, very violent and abusive language, and saying that it's up to them to see that what has to be done does get done.
And what they wanted to do was to bomb Cuba with nuclear weapons.
That's exactly right. And General Curtis LeMay, who's head of the Air Force, had authorized, not with Kennedy's support, Kennedy didn't even know what was happening, shooting test missiles out into the Pacific in the midst of the Cuban Missile Crisis from an airfield that also had nuclear-loaded missiles on it. So the Soviets would have been unable to distinguish one from the other. Fortunately, they didn't begin to respond because the Air Force was all ready to massively attack and create a nuclear war. outside the boundaries of anything Kennedy knew about or wanted.
It's really chilling.
It was very, very, very close. And Kennedy realized that and appealed to Khrushchev, who realized it from his standpoint because he had similar messages and he had similar pressures in his own situation.
Let's talk about Vietnam. I did see Kennedy as the person who really did first escalate the war in Vietnam, who sent in American, well, maybe didn't send in the original American advisors, but did a buildup of them. So talk about the situation there. You credit him with a change of heart there as well.
Well, he began with the war in Laos, the country right next to Vietnam, and in the spring of 61, his first spring as president, he refused CIA and Joint Chiefs of Staff's powerful recommendations that U.S. troops be sent heavily into Laos. So Kennedy was already engaged on the issue of Vietnam in terms of the overall region and had resisted any escalation in a country that was much more a focus than Vietnam at the time. But he did compromise. I think the way he was thinking was, I can't say no to my national security advisors on everything. So he agreed to military advisors that were part of a gradual escalation in Vietnam. Now, the military powers in Washington were asking for far, far more than he was giving, but he did go along there were no combat troops sent in, no combat battalions or anything of that nature, but there were advisors, and they kept getting to be more and more. But he then, in 1962, began asking for a plan by the Army for withdrawal from Vietnam, and they wouldn't give him one. They kept telling him, oh, this, that, or the other thing, and he kept insisting, I want a plan for withdrawal. And finally, his Secretary of Defense, McNamara, pushed it through in 63, and he actually signed a national security memorandum in October 63 for withdrawal of U.S. troops from Vietnam. But it was a winding trail, and he did compromise with his national security state on that one, and he had to take a very strong stand to sign that national security memorandum. Everybody around him was against it. He was virtually alone except for his Secretary of Defense, who obeyed orders from him, just as he obeyed the opposite orders from Lyndon Johnson later on.
It's ironic that you mention Robert McNamara, because, of course, under Johnson,
yes,
he turned around and was responsible for quite a bit of escalation of that war.
That is absolutely right. But he wrote his story of Vietnam, Robert McNamara did, and he was very clear that John Kennedy was opposed to continuing the war and actually did sign a national security memorandum against it, but McNamara went with the flow with Johnson and became profoundly involved in a terrible, terrible war.
Jim Douglas. We're talking with him about his book, JFK, The Unspeakable. Stay tuned for more of our conversation after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. John F. Kennedy was assassinated on November 22, 1963. We're talking with Jim Douglas about that assassination and why it happened. He's researching a series of assassinations he says were all connected, those of JFK, his brother Robert Kennedy, and Martin Luther King. Douglas argues that the covert national security apparatus of the United States, The CIA carried out those assassinations because their target posed a serious threat to the military-industrial complex. Back to Cuba, actually, there's another very interesting parallel development to the rapprochement between Kennedy and Khrushchev, and that's the one between Kennedy and Castro.
Yes. Well, Castro was very much alienated from Khrushchev because of the Cuban Missile Crisis. We have to remember that the reason those missiles were there from the standpoint of Castro, and Khrushchev too, to a large degree, was to deter an invasion from the superpower to the north of Cuba, the United States, which had already been involved in the Bay of Pigs. So for Khrushchev to respond to Kennedy's appeal without consulting Castro, which is exactly what he did because of the lack of time and also feeling that Castro would have reservations and that would delay it even further and they'd have a nuclear war in the meantime, Khrushchev had not consulted Castro. He just said publicly that I'm going to withdraw the missiles in return for Kennedy saying that he didn't plan to invade Cuba. Well, so what's Castro got on his part? Nothing from his standpoint except the promise of the capitalist president to the north. He doesn't have the missiles any longer. So Castro was furious with Khrushchev, furious with him, and he wouldn't even communicate with him. He just broke off all communication. So Khrushchev finally persuaded Castro half a year later to come to the Soviet Union for a rapprochement between the two of them, so that they could become allies and comrades again. And during that month that Castro went with Khrushchev around the Soviet Union, Khrushchev, of all things, gave him a teach-in regarding his secret correspondence with Kennedy. He kept reading him letters about how they were negotiating for peace now.
A teach-in, you said.
A teach-in, yeah. He was literally reading. He was literally reading for hours on end all this correspondence from between him and Kennedy to Castro, and Castro is trying to figure all of this stuff out. But he convinced Castro that Kennedy was someone they could work with. So Castro went back to Cuba convinced of that, and was already, when he received feelers from Kennedy as to whether or not he was interested in a dialogue with the President of the United States, and there were signs of that already in the spring of 63, because Kennedy was blocking CIA raids on Cuba to the consternation of the CIA, which kept raiding at a point where Kennedy was absolutely against it. So he was arresting members of the CIA and Cuban exile operatives for them, putting them in either in jail or keeping them from going out on the water at all in Cuba. And Castro recognized that Kennedy was taking very positive steps. And then when the fall, when Kennedy actually sent messages to Castro through an intermediary in the United Nations, Castro was ready, thanks to Khrushchev. So there was this incredible underlying connection between these three leaders that was ending in a foundational way the Cold War, and we out here were totally unaware of it.
And this was also at a time when the CIA was trying to assassinate Castro, and in fact,
they were
almost succeeded and didn't succeed. There was a diving suit involved.
Yes.
An almost incredible coincidence that avoided Castro being assassinated by the CIA. Tell us about that one.
Well, there was a lawyer named Donovan who was representing President Kennedy and his brother Robert Kennedy, the Attorney General, in negotiations with Castro to free the prisoners taken by Cuba at the Bay of Pigs, the U.S. prisoners. And during those negotiations, Donovan became quite friendly with Castro. When we meet our enemies, we always tend to have that problem that they become human for us. And in the process, Donovan gave Castro a diving suit as a gift. And the CIA almost simultaneously had prepared a diving suit that with poisonous substances in it to kill Castro. And they were trying to get this into Donovan's hands in such a way that it could be, quote, a gift for Castro. Now, had that succeeded, and fortunately it didn't because Donovan had his own suit and he was giving it in a friendly way to Castro, had the CIA plot succeeded, it would, of course, been traced back to John Kennedy. So he would have been scapegoated with the assassination of Castro, whom he was trying to negotiate with for the release of the Cuban prisoners. And of course, he was trying to negotiate further with him for peace. So the CIA was not only trying to kill Castro, but trying to blame it on the president.
It's an incredible story. You almost see the divine hand of Providence in there.
It was an extraordinary series of events. If you put it in terms of the Christian Gospels, you could say all that Kennedy and Khrushchev were doing is practicing what Jesus said, love your enemies. And that's as understood by Gandhi, in which love means, you know, not a sentimental thing, but it means respect, it means dialogue, it means discovering the truth of the person that you seem to be most opposed to. And that's what was happening between Kennedy and Khrushchev, and even between Kennedy and Castro.
Now, it wasn't really just the CIA that
you
say wanted Kennedy dead. I mean, in some way, you go far further, I think, than most people who have talked about this whole chain of events and the assassination, because what you really say is that the CIA are the operatives,
yes,
but behind them is something far more core,
yes,
to our society, to our economy. That's the military-industrial complex, which Eisenhower warned us against. You have an incredible story about Big Steel that I think really illustrates what you're talking about here. Give us that story.
That occurred the year before his assassination. It was the spring before the Cuban Missile Crisis. And Big Steel, the major steel corporations in the United States, had been involved with the president, with President Kennedy, and the union in stopping what Kennedy identified as the wage-price spiral, you know, where higher wages and higher prices keep spiraling higher and higher and higher and hurting the economy. And as a result of that agreement that was reached between the steel company and the labor union, Kennedy thought the situation was stabilized. And then he was given a fait accompli by a man named Roger Blau, who was the head of U.S. Steel, in his office. He was simply informed that U.S. Steel had directly violated that agreement that they had reached with the labor union through Kennedy's mediation, and they were going ahead. And a whole bunch of other steel companies were following suit, and Kennedy was just being told about it. And he couldn't believe what he was being told, that they had just were walking all over him. And for the following week, he and the administration waged a public campaign against U.S. Steel, in which one of the key ways in which they did it was to pull back all the major defense contracts of U.S. Steel and the other big corporations and hand them over to smaller defense contractors who were respecting the agreement that Kennedy had made and were not raising their prices. Now, this is big-time warfare between the President of the United States and the most powerful corporations in the United States. This is the essence of the military-industrial complex, the steel corporations. And finally, they backed off. They surrendered to Kennedy, but that was not something that they did in a spirit of total reconciliation, to put it mildly. And a sign of what this all resulted in was an editorial in Fortune magazine the following month, and this had all taken place in April, and so they titled their editorial, this is Henry Luce's big magazine, The Ides of April, and of course that's a reference to the prediction of Julius Caesar's assassination. So they're warning Kennedy, you are in deep, deep water as a result of what you have done. And from that point on, the business community hated John Kennedy, and he tried to build some bridges, but it never worked. He and Robert were from that point on regarded as persona non grata by the business community, the essence of the military-industrial complex.
So, I mean, we're not saying that Luce was involved in the assassination, but how do you make those connections between the military-industrial complex and the CIA? How do you see the relationship whereby the wishes, if even the unconscious wishes of one, are carried out by the actions of the other?
I'm not sure they're unconscious. I think they're quite conscious. Henry Luce, Alan Dulles, these people were in the same circles. They were constant communicators. They were at the highest levels of the society. Alan Dulles had been a Wall Street lawyer for decades before he became head of the CIA. They all moved in the same circles. And the way I would describe the decision to murder President Kennedy is not that there was one primary conspirator behind, you know, one single individual person behind this thing. I believe it was consensus at the very highest levels that this man had to go. He was countering the entire ethos of the Cold War, the military-industrial complex. In his great speech, his American University address, President Kennedy on June 10, 1963, when he spoke to the graduating students at American University, he said his theme was world peace, the greatest subject on earth. And he said, what kind of peace do I want? What kind of peace do I mean? He said, not a Pax Americana enforced on the world by American weapons of war. Well, that's exactly what the military-industrial complex was doing, was enforcing on the world by American weapons of war, a Pax Americana. He was diametrically opposed to the whole works in June of 63. So that speech is an articulation of a position counter to the entire reality of what Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex. And that speech is the prelude to his assassination, in the same way that Martin Luther King's April 4, 67 Riverside Church address is the prelude to his assassination.
You mean the one in which he went against the Vietnam War?
Right. Mm-hmm. And identified the United States government as the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. Well, Kennedy was, in essence, saying something very similar when he reached out to the Soviet Union in his American University address and unilaterally stated that he was going to stop testing nuclear weapons in the atmosphere in order to negotiate a test ban treaty with the Soviet Union. He did all kinds of things in that speech that countered the military-industrial complex. It was a statement of his wish to end the Cold War, and that military-industrial complex is the reality which the CIA is enforcing by carrying out coordinating the assassination.
And I'd like to remind our listeners that we're speaking with James W. Douglas about his book, JFK and the Unspeakable. So you mentioned Martin Luther King. Do you think that there are some similar forces behind the assassinations, behind the murders of Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, and Robert Kennedy?
They're the same forces. This is a fourfold story, and that's what I'm working on, actually. Fourfold story, our story, in the 1960s. And each one of those key leaders, one a president, another a president-to-be, RFK would have been elected president had he not been assassinated, and two prophets, Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, from very different perspectives, they were coming at fundamental change within the United States that would have turned us away from the national security state that now prevails. And you can't have a democracy within a national security state. They are incompatible. Kennedy was realizing that, and his assassination is an example of the incompatibility, because as president he was trying to carry out a vision and an agenda that was not his national security state. So he, quote, had to go. The same was the case for Martin Luther King, because from another perspective, the peace and justice movement, he had realized that the Vietnam War was a huge barrier to not only justice within the United States, but within the entire world, and was moving us toward self-destruction. And he took that position to stop the Vietnam War, and then in another major decision to launch a poor people's campaign to end poverty within the United States. And that put him in opposition to the military-industrial complex in which poverty is a continuing reality and part of the system. So Martin Luther King had to go in the same way. Now, Malcolm X is a very different kind of person. He wasn't committed to nonviolence, but he was committed to putting the United States on trial in the United Nations for racism alongside South Africa. And that's the untold story behind his assassination. And Robert Kennedy is, of course, a parallel to his brother. He wanted to end the Vietnam War. And when he became president, perhaps of equal significance, he wanted to reopen the investigation into the murder of JFK. He had to go, too.
What are the implications of this for Obama? I mean, Obama was elected on the platform of change.
Yes.
And I think since there's been remarkably little change since he's come into office. Do you think that he's too afraid to make the changes that he promised?
He's certainly hemmed in, as any president is. Whether he's too afraid, I can't answer that. I hope not. I hope that right now he's in the process of turning, as John Kennedy was. We witness the way in which people who are supposed to be his subordinates, namely generals in Afghanistan, are telling him what he needs to do, even lobbying publicly for a huge increase in troops in Afghanistan. Now, that's the kind of behavior that General Curtis LeMay was giving to John Kennedy, and Kennedy faced him down, and Kennedy also fired Alan Dulles when he tried to manipulate him. So maybe President Obama needs to do something along the same lines. And in order for us to survive as a people, that's more important than whether or not he survives his presidency. John Kennedy didn't survive his presidency, but he did allow us to survive as a people. I firmly believe that had Kennedy not taken the decisions that he did in the Bay of Pigs, in the Cuban Missile Crisis, at the American University, and step by step until the point where he died, that we wouldn't be having this conversation right now, because this would be a nuclear wasteland. So because that president had the courage to turn, we're still around. We still have a chance. We still have a chance. President Obama needs to make similar decisions, but he needs to do so in the context of a people, namely ourselves, who understand what is at stake and who understand the precedent in John F. Kennedy. If we understand, then Obama's going to be able to turn in a more hopeful way, that is, with popular support and with understanding of what he's up against, that takes into consideration the precedent, namely John Kennedy's courage, his vision of peace, and the assassination that he experienced as a result. We don't want that to happen again.
So I'd just like to ask you, in terms of the assassination itself, you lay out the case that Lee Harvey Oswald was a CIA asset.
Yes.
What's the evidence for that, and where did you get it?
From documents, from witnesses, from trails all over the place. Oswald, in his Marine career, was a CIA radar operator at Atsugi Air Force Base in Japan for the U-2, the top-secret plane that the United States was sending over China, the Soviet Union, in years when people in the United States knew nothing of this. Of course, people at the high levels in the Soviet Union knew about it because they were spotting the plane, unable to shoot it down until it went too low at a certain point. And Lee Oswald, over at Atsugi Air Force Base, he knew all about the U-2. He had the highest possible security clearance, higher than top secret. And when Oswald left the Marines under a very suspicious discharge, where his mother supposedly had some very small illness, he then, within a few months, was over in the Soviet Union, and he was at the U.S. Embassy saying that he was going to wanted to give up his citizenship and become a Soviet citizen. Well, that's extremely suspicious because what's going on here? Well, what's going on, as we know from documents, for example, Oswald was meeting with a man who had, quote, recently resigned his job in the CIA and become a top official in the U.S. Embassy in Moscow. Well, that's in effect saying he's still in the CIA. Oswald was a counterintelligence operative for the CIA in the Soviet Union for a couple of years, and that's when he met Marina, who was a counterintelligence operative from the Soviet side. She, her uncle, her family were all involved in the Soviet side of espionage. So Oswald, when he came back to the U.S. and said, "Oh, you know, I'm sorry I did all this," and he's embraced by the State Department, given monetary loans. Well, he should have been prosecuted from the standpoint of what he'd done. Here he was saying to the embassy before he stays in the Soviet Union, "I'm going to give up all the top secrets that I learned as a CIA radar operator on the U-2 spy plane." Of course, none of this is made public in the Warren Commission, but this is all documented. We know that this is what Oswald did.
Now, there was another plot to assassinate Kennedy before the one that came to fruition in Dallas. Tell us about the Chicago plot.
The Chicago plot is the same as the Dallas plot. There is a sniper team, a four-man sniper team to assassinate the president as he is taken on a motorcade through the city, in this case on the way to a football game, and that was scheduled for November the 2nd of 1963, almost 3 weeks short of the actual assassination. There was, just as there would be in Dallas, a scapegoat. In the case of the Chicago plot, it was Thomas Arthur Valley, an ex-Marine, like Lee Harvey Oswald, who had worked, like Lee Harvey Oswald, as a Marine at a CIA base in Japan, like Lee Harvey Oswald, and who, after his discharge from the Marines, continued working with the Central Intelligence Agency, like Lee Harvey Oswald, and even in helping to train anti-Castro people who were being sent down to Cuba, just like Lee Harvey Oswald. And that man, Thomas Arthur Valley, was employed, not coincidentally, right over the motorcade that Kennedy was scheduled to take into Chicago. Well, fortunately, there were some whistleblowers in that instance, including an unidentified person whose name was Lee. We only know the name Lee. I suspect it was Lee Harvey Oswald. And as a result of the whistleblowers, the plot was stopped, and a very remarkable man named Abraham Bolden has informed people about it. I've interviewed him 7 times. He was a Secret Service agent. He had been part of the White House detail, thanks to John Kennedy hiring him personally. And in Chicago, he observed this plot and observed key elements of it that would be exactly duplicated in Dallas. And he, the most important thing he observed is that what went down in Chicago was blocked from public information, and so there was no warning that exactly the same thing would happen in Dallas. Kennedy, fortunately, at the very 11th hour, canceled his trip to Chicago, so he was not killed in Chicago, and he got 3 weeks more before he was killed by exactly the same kind of plot in Dallas.
Wow. This is just one small part of the many unbelievable revelations in this book, JFK and the Unspeakable. Thanks so much, James Douglas, for talking with us.
Thank you, Francesca.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.